This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll find out how Hartford ranks in the global insurance market. Are we still the insurance capital of the world? We'll also hear about Sam Colt's Revolver, Eli Whitney's Cotney Gin, and Katharine Hepburn's Oscars. What do they all have in common? I mean, besides the fact they all resided in Connecticut. We'll find out. But first, it's a story we covered in the beginning of the summer. As part of an investigation, the State Department of Education released findings back in July that Darien's school district violated federal and state special education law. The story didn't end there, though. The superintendent of schools has now resigned, and the district is dealing with a forensic audit. So what is a forensic audit? Well, we'll find out with Darien Times reporter David DeRoche. He's been covering this complicated story, and you can read more at DarienTimes.com. David, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thanks for having me on, John.
So since last we talked, there has been an awful lot of movement in this story about special education in the town of Darien. Before we get into the new details, maybe you could just take us through how we got to where we are. What's the story that you've been following?
Well, it's quite a complex story that starts in 2009 with some over expenses in special education in the Darien public school system. After the expenses became a concern for the town, the school district decided to hire a new special education director who came in, started making some changes. A number of people left the district. Parents started to express concerns to the Board of Education. The concerns went to the administration. Their concerns weren't met. They filed a complaint with the state. The state came back a couple of months after that, finding illegal activity in the special education department. And the story really goes on from there. And to really get into it requires, you know, as you can imagine, quite some time to really dive into the details. It's ended with this resignation of the superintendent. The Board of Ed has hired four different people to clean up the mess, and they recently ordered a forensic audit into their excess cost reimbursements.
So, well, let's go back a little closer to the start then, because there is a lot to unravel here. What were the concerns that were coming out of the parents in the Darien school system, the parents of kids with some sort of special needs, how they felt like this new director and the school district was treating them?
Well, as it was confirmed in an independent report that was delivered on Monday by a Chicago attorney who did a two-month investigation into special education, she found that the district was not involving parents in the decision-making progress of their children's education, which is part of the federal law that requires districts to involve parents. They found the parents were not involved. They found that changes were made to children's education plans without parental notification. So, say, a child might have been getting certain services, the administration would eliminate those services and then not tell parents about them. And then when parents would find out that this had happened, they would address it with the administration, and the administration would refer to it as a clerical error. But as far as how many children may have been affected, it's still quite unclear. The independent investigator did not examine that. She's actually has asked the schools to determine how many children may have been affected. Originally, the state investigation had put the onus on parents to determine if their children were harmed. So the investigator's decision to put it on the school district is a change. However, some people are still kind of concerned that there's still people in the district who might not have the children's best interest in mind. So they're kind of afraid that if the school looks into it, there might not be an objective analysis of how many children may have been harmed.
Now, did this investigation determine what the reasons were for this these actions on behalf of the school district? Why, indeed, their students weren't being treated the right way? Did it really just come down to wanting to save money for the school district?
It appears to be that way. The investigator dove into kind of the motivations behind it, and there were a lot of interaction with the Board of Finance members, with the school board, on the need to rein in spending, the need to manage costs. There was very little discussion over education. And, John, I'd like to mention something about the culture, which I think is what really led to these policies. The Darien prides itself on having the best and best education for all students. The U.S. News and World Report listed high school as the number one in state. But it appears to have deferred to the appropriate standard that's defined under federal law. Now, the school district has hired this man, John Veer, who is as the interim special education director. His term is actually the special education ombudsman, and he wants the best for students with special needs. He discusses the need for equity in terms of outcomes of education, but he might find some pushback because there's still a fairly strong contingency in town that considers special education as either a drain or at best it should deliver the minimum amount of services under the appropriate standard. Now, some have said that the excessive services under the formal special ed director created the climate for the illegal changes to take place. However, the district performed an independent study in 2010 that found that only 5% of staff members felt the district was doing too much for children with special needs. So it appears that the need to save money was a driving factor, and the investigator actually cited that in her report. However, the Board of Finance and the Board of Education have vehemently denied that that was in their charge. Obviously, they did not never told anyone to break any laws, but that is actually what has happened.
Well, and one of the things, when we talked to you about this before, and we're talking today with David DeRoche, who's an assistant editor with the Darien Times, who's been following this really, really scandal that's been happening within the Darien School District around special education. It's led to the resignation of the superintendent there. It's something we've been following here on the show. This idea of a need to save money, it strikes many of us in the rest of the state as very interesting. Here's Darien. It's one of the richest towns in the state. It's one of the richest communities in the entire country. And there's a sense that it has a very good school system and that it might be able to well afford special education services for all the students. I think there's also some people watching this story who might say, well, there's a lot of rich people in Darien who, if they want to get special education services for their children, they can afford to take them outside, to go to some sort of a private school where they might get these services. That's what a lot of the people from the outside are saying about this. Maybe you can pull apart a couple of these things, because I know that these are important issues that are coming up in the conversations that are happening in Darien today.
Sure. Well, first I'd like to address the issue that Darien obviously has the money to pay for these services. I think if this has happened in a town that has the resources to provide these services, one can only imagine what's taking place in places such as Bridgeport or Hartford, where parents do not have the resources. As I've gone through this story, it appears that this problem is not restricted to Darien, that it is a nationwide problem, because there really is no oversight from the federal government. The Council on Disability has found that every state has been in violation of federal law when it comes to special education. However, there's never been any kind of enforcement mechanism really in place. There is, however, it's never been used. The only enforcement mechanism is to cease funding to a district. And so even if that happened to Darien, it would not harm them that much, because they, you know, are a wealthy community. And a lot of parents have taken their kids and put them in private school at their own expense. That's something that parents have done in this town because they have that ability. However, some parents believe in public schools and believe that they should abide by the law and that their children should get the appropriate education that they are required under law. So it's really quite a complex issue, as you can imagine, and the issues you pointed out are something that we've been quite aware of.
And just to be clear, those services that are mandated by state law to be provided for kids who need special education services, that is a law. That's not something where you can just say, well, parents, if you want something different, you can take your kids to a private school. In essence, no matter what school district it is, Greenwich, Darien, New Canaan, all the best school districts in the state, they all have to provide their services just the same as anyone else does. So talk a bit about what some of the fallout has been since our last conversation. The superintendent of the school district has resigned around this, David?
Yes, he resigned, I believe, a few weeks ago. We did an editorial that asked for the town to consider whether or not it chose the right leaders, and we questioned his leadership, and we challenged him to either step up to the plate or resign. And not to say that our editorial had anything to do with that, but that was the sense in the community, that he had mismanaged this crisis. Now, I don't think that, and I think I speak on behalf of people who have spoken to me, numerous people who have said that the superintendent was not the orchestrator of these problems. He made some management errors throughout the problems, but he was not the orchestrator. But him leaving shows the seriousness of this issue. There are still people in the district that some parents and others have expressed concern about their role in the school district and working with children. But the Board of Education has really stepped up to the plate. They've hired a bunch of pretty well-known, nationally renowned educators to fix this mess, and it looks to be heading in the right direction. The ombudsman, John Veer, has a quite a different vision for the district than in the past, and whether or not he'll face pushback remains to be seen.
Last thing for you, David. You know, we talked about the superintendent resigning and the role of the Board of Education. We just had municipal elections. Anything change there?
There was not a big change in the elections. You know, I hate to politicize this, but it's become a political issue. Republicans are controlling the Board of Education, the Board of Finance, and the Board of Selectmen. The Board of Selectmen don't have much to do with this, but there are Republicans in town who have expressed concern over their leadership throughout this role. The recent elections did not have any change. Show any change. There were three new members elected to the board, and I believe the three new members all have a positive vision for improving transparency with the Board of Education, improving communication, which were two issues that were quite a problem throughout this whole process. So even though there was no change from the political spectrum, there are new personalities on the board, and so that looks to be a positive for many.
David DeRoche is assistant editor of the Darien Times. He's been following the story about special education in the town of Darien. For us. David, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on, John. I appreciate it.
If you want to read more on this story, you can go to DarienTimes.com or you can link to our website, WNPR.org. Coming up, a Smithsonian collection of objects that represents the American experience. And there's a gathering of insurance executives in Hartford. Are we still the insurance capital of the world? You can join our conversation. Email wherelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherelive. We'll be right back. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, the Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects. But first, is Hartford still the insurance capital of the world? According to the 2012 Insurance Market Report, we're still a major player. Connecticut ranked first nationally in insurance employment. Later this month, insurance executives will gather in the capital city to talk about trends and to showcase Hartford as a key player in the marketplace. Joining us to preview the insurance market forecast is Susan Winkler, Executive Director of the Connecticut Insurance and Financial Services Cluster. Susan, welcome to Where We Live.
And thank you, John, for having me.
Maybe you can explain what this event is all about. What are you trying to do?
Okay, well, you know, just as you said earlier, I think the Insurance and Financial Services Cluster Executive Board have heard for so many years that, you know, when Hartford was or when Connecticut was the insurance capital or do you think we are, and there's always been a layer of doubt with the title. And so a few years ago, we decided to do some due diligence on statistics, and we hired a Connecticut Economic Resource Center. And we looked into where are we and where is Connecticut's insurance industry today. And, in fact, we are the insurance capital. At least I could say that of the nation by virtue of some very, very important statistics, ranking number one in a lot of different categories, which I can talk about later. But it was time for us to say, you know, take the title back and rebrand ourselves as the insurance capital because we really are. And the insurance market forecast is a culmination of a lot of ideas and ways to showcase the thought leadership, the professional expertise that we have here in Connecticut, in such a small state, and how we impact the real national and global landscape of insurance.
Well, tell us some of those numbers that you were talking about. What are the numbers that you have that prove that Connecticut is indeed still this major player, this insurance capital?
Sure. We're still number one, for example, in total insurance jobs and employment, so to speak, as a percentage of total employment. So while we're a small state, we have the most insurance jobs than any other state in Connecticut and in the U.S. as you look at that as a per capita. We also rank number one in all written life insurance premium. And we rank number two, which is still a good rank, for all total direct written premium in the U.S. We have the highest concentration of actuaries. That's a very important fact. And again, if you look at just, let's say, comparing gross state product, amongst the other states in the country, we rank number one again as it relates to a percentage of total gross state product. We are number one.
How is the overall insurance job marketplace faring nationwide? Because we've been hearing for years here in Connecticut about job losses at the big insurers, some places shuffling their deck chairs, moving into state, moving out of state. I guess I'm wondering how the overall market for insurance employment in this country looks right now.
You know, it's still growing very, very slowly. Nationally, the growth year over year is about 1%. Connecticut is still in the negative. but yet we're still improving. And I do place some caution with the Connecticut numbers, because I'm not sure, you know, there's still some statistics you should think about. As our numbers are not growing as maybe as steadily as the U.S., a lot of the outsourcing model is still prevailing. And so some of those jobs from the insurance companies, i.e. IT, actuarial, all those advisory services and business services are still being employed, but they're being employed outside the insurance company. And those types of business service companies are growing. So while we don't have the true numbers of exponential growth, some of those numbers are taking place outside the insurance companies, but those companies, those employees and companies are still supporting the industry.
We're talking with Susan Winkler, who's executive director of the Connecticut Insurance and Financial Services Cluster, talking about whether or not Connecticut is indeed still the insurance capital of the world. Her group seems to think so. And on November 12th at the Connecticut Convention Center in Hartford, they're bringing together the insurance market forecast. We're talking a bit about the insurance industry in the state here on Where We Live. One thing that I think has changed, not just in the insurance industry, but in every single industry, is that we really do live in this global world and people can do business in a much different way than they used to. So I guess the first question I have for you, Susan, is there a need for a concentration of people in the insurance industry and associated fields to actually live close together in a place like Hartford, or can you really do a whole lot of this business just over the internet almost any place?
I think there's some value to still having the employee base centered around a cluster like we have in Connecticut. As I said earlier, because the insurance companies are intertwined with the third-party service providers, that network, that empowerment of employee base is just so critical to creating strength, economic development strength in an industry, which is why what we have here in Connecticut. So it is still vitally important.
But it's not the same sort of thing as, say, manufacturing, where, you know, you actually have to physically be in a place. And if a manufacturing company moves, you know, those people who know how to build that widget either have to go to where the new jobs are, or they have to find new jobs where they are. Is there some sense that the insurance industry is changing enough that might allow for different sorts of workflows, that might allow for people to not necessarily, you know, in 10 years all live clustered around an insurance capital, but might be able to do business from wherever?
Well, I think the model has changed over the years, but the concentration still is important. And that actually even goes into our academic and our academia, where, of course, you're still trying to build and educating the next-gen workforce. That has to be somewhere. And when you concentrate it here, let's say, for example, in the insurance capital, we're able to work with our academic partners to start growing the next-generation workforce because we have the relationships that are in proximity to each other.
I'm wondering how the skills in the insurance industry are changing or have changed over time. Do you see young people wanting to get into employment in the big insurance companies in Connecticut in the same way they have in the past? And are the skills that they need to have to get into this business different than they were 5 or 10 years ago?
Yeah, I would say that they have changed. The skills that the insurance companies are now seeking are STEM-related, highly analytical, technically based. And outside of that, there's the soft skills that are just so essential to moving what you, as you considered earlier, a global industry. So communication skills, both verbal and written, are always essential. I track, actually, what the employers are looking for on a quarterly basis. And the analytical skills and the communication skills always rise to the top as what they are looking, HR recruiters are looking for all levels of employment in the industry.
Insurance companies, in a lot of ways, have gotten a pretty bad rap in the last couple of years. And I think in large part this is due to the rollout of Obamacare, with the insurance companies seen, at least in the healthcare field, as having been bad actors that the government has to come in and fix. I have a couple questions about the Affordable Care Act and how it's affecting the business, but I guess I'll just start with you commenting perhaps on that idea, trying to change the perception of what insurance companies actually do for people, given an awful lot that's been written and talked about, and honestly some real personal experiences that have come forward in the media where people have, you know, seemingly gotten pretty bad service from their insurers over the years.
I think it's an important time for the the perception of insurance companies to enlighten, I guess, the general public and consumers, because insurance companies are there for the consumer. That is their role. And it is a pivotal time right now in our history, as you know, and in the world of insurance. We live in a more dangerous world, as everybody knows. You've got climate change looming and evolving, and I think it's ever more important that we look at protecting our property and assets and preserving assets as we get older. We have an aging population. Our health is very, very important. How are we preserving assets? How are we protecting our health going forward? So right now, all of those critical issues are all part of the insurance industry's landscape. It's what they do. They put the lens of the consumer across all of those, and that's how they build their products. So I think that while there might have been some, you know, there is always a continual challenge with the media, I think that if you put it in the lens of what the insurance companies are doing as it relates to protection, consumer protection, what they're doing within climate change, how they're looking at preserving assets and helping everyone remain healthy, I think it really is an important time for the general public to get more aware of what the importance of the insurance industry in their lives.
Getting back to this idea of what insurance companies have had to do to change around so-called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, I mean, right now all the talk is that the federal government can't get its stuff together and actually put together a website that allows you to choose a better option. But when Obamacare first rolled out, the thing that people were talking about, at least people who supported this plan, said, well, finally now the insurance companies are being forced, their hand is being forced, they can't exclude people for pre-existing conditions, etc. I guess I'm wondering if you can talk about that partnership with government around the Affordable Care Act, how insurers that you work with have dealt with this, because essentially, I mean, that's what happened. The Obama administration said there's certain things that we're not going to accept from insurers if you're going to be part of the solution moving forward in helping to keep people healthy, and the insurance companies had to go along. Talk about that evolution.
Well, I don't know if I can speak on behalf of those conversations because I wasn't privy to those conversations, but I do know from the standpoint of the insurance companies, they worked extensively with the administration to put forward a product that would be that would meet the needs and the goals of ACA, as well as to look at, you know, their business models and how they would align. So I can't talk specifically about all of the details because, again, I wasn't privy to those conversations, but I do know that there is certainly a partnership within the insurance industry to make sure, again, consumers first, looking at their health and well-being is always a first priority, and then trying just to make it work the best they can.
This question of climate change has come up that I want to get back to. You know, the insurance industry has had to really think about what is going to happen to our planet, as we clearly now know. Temperatures are rising. Water levels are rising. That puts in great jeopardy not just people's lives, but billions and billions of dollars worth of real estate, a waterfront property, all sorts of things that, frankly, I think a lot of America, Susan, wasn't really concerned about until Katrina nearly wiped a great American city off the face of the earth. Talk about how that has changed in the insurance marketplace, because this is a really big thing for your industry.
It is a big thing, and I know that there has been, again, this is an important time for regulators, insurance companies to work together towards solutions towards that, because climate change looks like it's with us. I mean, I think you're right. Katrina put us all in a different place, and from that point forward, it seems like we've been on this continuum of climate changes and horrific storms and things that we've had to adapt to. But I can assure you that the insurance companies, at least the ones that I represent, have been very much in tune with trying to come up with different types of solutions to help the consumers, whether it's building codes or trying to work at different organizations that help define whether it's low-carbon emissions. And some of them are investing very much so in climate change. If you look at some of where the insurance companies are taking some of their capital dollars, they're putting into climate change so they can understand it better, and that way they can adapt their products accordingly.
What are some other trends that when you folks get together next week and start talking as a group that you're going to be addressing, that you're going to be trying to flesh out?
Healthcare, climate change, the world we live in and the risks associated with that, and then, of course, preserving wealth and health and assets, I think is really a top priority.
Well, when it comes to, you know, living in a world that's dangerous and a world in which a lot of people are afraid, I'll throw out something that I'd love to hear the insurance industry tackle in a little bit different way, is the topic of guns. America has more guns than just about any other country in the entire world. And culturally, it seems very difficult for us to change that in any substantive way. There have been some pretty serious discussions about guns and gun culture in this last year. But there's also, Susan, some really good data that suggests that the more guns we have, the less safe we are as a society. I guess I'm wondering where the insurance industry as a whole comes down on this idea of guns in America, because, you know, given the partnerships that the industry has formed with the Obama administration around the Affordable Care Act, he's tried really hard to get gun control legislation passed. I'm wondering if the insurance industry might take a leadership role in that question as well.
You know, it's a question to be asked to the insurance industry. I don't have an answer to that question as it relates to an overall general industry statement, because it has not been at least brought up in my organization for me, and enough for me to talk about with some type of statement of fact.
But what about the other issue that's come up in this last year, of course, since the tragedy at Sandy Hook is essentially linked in the conversation with guns, is the conversation about mental health. And I know that some of the issues of mental health have been addressed,
yes,
by the Affordable Care Act. But again, this is something where, you know, mental health advocates have been asking for parity, both in the medical field and the insurance field, for quite some time. How does mental health play into all the things that you're looking at?
Well, the insurance companies take that very seriously and are working with the regulators to develop certain types of programs. I know that the state just unrolled something recently here. So there is definitely a partnership. There's certainly a focus on that from the insurance industry as well.
And so during this event that's coming up next week,
yep,
are you going to be having presentations from people in your industry, from outside your industry? I mean, give us a little bit better scope of what exactly is going to happen.
Well, I think, and I will just preface by saying, you know, based on everything we just talked about, John, Connecticut is just very well positioned as the nation's insurance capital to lead on all these issues, based on the companies that are here, the executive thought leadership that's here, those that are molding the patterns and the models to address all of those issues. And, yes, there'll be a regulatory panel. So that will be led with the NAIC. Senator Nelson will lead the keynote, followed by a regulatory panel, and we will host Commissioner Donilon from Louisiana. So back to Katrina issues. We'll have Superintendent Bedlosky on the panel from New York, and our own Commissioner Tom Leonardi will speak on regulatory affairs as it relate to the country and the globe. We have executives coming from United Healthcare, Lincoln Financial, Mass Mutual, and Travelers. And there's the other side of insurance and coming together to kind of forecast where the industry is going. So I think Connecticut is so well positioned to showcase the fact that here we are, you know, the insurance capital again, by virtue of data and stats, which I gave you earlier.
Yeah.
But not that, not only that, here's where you can come to this event and listen and learn about the shaping of the industry.
The Connecticut Convention Center hosts the Insurance Market Forecast on November 12th. That's next week. If you want to register and find out more information, it's ConnecticutIFS.com. Again, ConnecticutIFS.com. We'll have more on our website as well, WNPR.org. Our guest has been Susan Winkler. She's Executive Director of the Connecticut Insurance and Financial Services Cluster. Thanks so much for spending some time with us and talking about this really interesting industry. It's going to be, I think, a pretty interesting confab of big thinkers in insurance.
John, if there's anything I can leave you to, I just want you to say the insurance capital of the world is Connecticut, and then we're good.
So we heard it here first. We're still the insurance capital of the world. Thanks, Susan.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, Lincoln's stovepipe hat, Dorothy's ruby slippers, Harriet Tubman's hymnal. Just a few of the items in the Smithsonian's new literary exhibition of the history of America in 101 objects. We'll find out what else made the list, including some Connecticut connections. It's coming up right after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Please join me tonight at Real Artways in Hartford for a conversation with Congressman Luis Gutierrez. His new book is called Still Dreaming, My Journey from the Barrio to Capitol Hill. We'll be talking about immigration and immigration reform in America and his personal journey. That's tonight at Real Artways in Hartford. If you want to find out more, go to our website, WNPR.org, or you can visit Real Artways' website. The Declaration of Independence, Lewis and Clark's compass, Alexander Graham Bell's first phone, Dorothy's ruby slippers, Harriet Tubman's hymnal, and even Julia Child's kitchen. This list is not just a random assortment of historical ephemera, but it's all part of Smithsonian Institute's newly released book chronicling the history of America in 101 objects. The Institute went about assembling a literary exhibition that could collectively represent the American experience. And joining us to talk about these objects and more is Richard Curran, Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture at the Smithsonian Institute. Welcome to Where We Live.
Well, nice to be here, John.
Well, first of all, we have to ask, with the Smithsonian's 137 million items or so, how exactly did you come to these 101 objects for this book?
Well, with a lot of difficulty, to be sure. And as you can imagine, curators at the Smithsonian, and there's hundreds of them, feel very passionately about everything. Our airplane guys feel passionate about them, our stamp people about them. And so we had to be somewhat judicious, but we wanted to tell the sweep of American history and deal with everything from politics and freedom to popular culture to civil rights, invention, and so on.
So what do objects tell us? I mean, some people would say they're just things, but you do have a narrative here that really does seem to tell all of American history in these items, these objects.
Well, you know, look, John, you know, when I learned, history in, school growing up and then in college, you'd often learn, like, names and dates and places, and it has a kind of abstract character to it. But when you're dealing with objects, you're dealing with things that actually touched history, that were part of it. And so I think they convey in a much more stronger, visceral sense the idea of actually being part of history. And then, you know, you look at an object and, you know, at the Smithsonian we have the Star Spangled Banner. That's the item that people around the country, you know, sing about, you know, oh, say, can you see, every Saturday and Sunday across the country. Well, that actually pertains to a real flag. And so when you deal with that flag, you say, well, how did it get to be like that? How did that get to inspire our national anthem? And what does it mean to our country?
Well, there are so many items in here that I want to talk about. Some of them have connections to where we live here in Connecticut, and
sure.
Some are just broadly interesting. So let's go through a few. And the first one in chronological order that I wanted to ask you about was this beautiful and kind of strange 1648 map of the Americas. I'm wondering if you can describe this for our listeners, because if you take a look at this map, it really is an idea of what the New World must have looked like to Europeans of the time, and it bears some resemblance of what we actually know as the New World now, but there's a lot of differences too.
Well, you know, when you realize when people started making maps, Europeans are making maps of the Americas. This is in the aftermath of Columbus, and of course it's Amerigo Vespucci who makes the first map that actually names America. Interestingly enough to Americans, America was actually the name for South America, not North America. It had a completely different Parias. It had a different name, and it was thought to be really islands of the Caribbean with Florida sticking out. Well, as you look at this map, made it in the 1640s, this is when, you know, the first colonies, Jamestown, Plymouth, and so on are being settled. New England, you have explorers settling. And so it's kind of an outline of the United States. It's very strong in the southeast, Florida and the Caribbean. It's very strong in Mexico and along the border because that was the frontier of Spanish colonization. And you do have some points of interest on the west coast, on the California coast. You have New England kind of going up to Newfoundland, and then the whole rest of the United States, all those big 10 states, all those states in the Midwest, a complete blank, nothing known about them. It's largely determined by ships and sea and navigation. And so that's our knowledge of the world. Of course, that expands in the decades following.
Of course. It's just so interesting to see such an intricately detailed map of, say, towns and cities, settlements in Mexico, a place that so many Americans probably couldn't find on a map today. And just, as you say, nothing in the upper Midwest of the United States.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. Well, of course, here in Connecticut, there's a lot of inventors and people with these great New England traditions of invention. The first of the two I want to come to is Eli Whitney's cotton gin. Tell us a little bit about the story of the cotton gin and why you decided to include it here in this book.
Well, you know, the cotton gin had a tremendous impact on this country. Now, at first, Eli Whitney goes down to Georgia. He meets another Yale graduate, revolutionary hero, Nathaniel Greene. The South is grappling with, you know, agriculture. The country at this time in the late 1700s is an agricultural country. And in the South, you know, you had tobacco very on in colonization, but it destroyed a lot of the soils and wasn't quite ideal. Cotton would work in Southern agriculture, but there was a problem. Short staple cotton, that is, cotton has a lot of seeds in it from the boils. And the problem is, how do you get rid of all those seeds? And there was not a good engine and not a good machine, so it all had to be done by hand, which made cotton not very productive from an economic point of view. What Eli Whitney did, working with others, and there were a lot of inventors. The way invention works is a lot of people work on a problem at the same time, and you're never quite sure who's going to come up with the solution. But Whitney came up with a way of having these metal arms or spikes weed out the cotton seeds of short staple cotton. That basically made it economically efficient to farm, but it also, what it did, it kicked off the whole growing of cotton and the expansion of slavery through the South. And so what made this invention that had a tremendous labor-saving consequence also made cotton the primary export crop of the United States. It ended up over the years not only expanding slavery but also paying for great plantations, and of course, leading to the consequences and the conditions of the Civil War.
We're talking with Richard Curran, who's Smithsonian Institution's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture, the author of The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects, and we're taking a look at some of these objects with him here in this brand new book here on Where We Live. Of course, right here in Hartford, an invention that helped to build this city and also had its own consequences was Samuel Colt's revolver. Tell us a bit of this story.
Well, yeah, Colt's revolver is a great story. There were all sorts of firearms being developed. American colonists wouldn't have been successful unless they had muskets to deal with Indians and others during colonization. But the Colt develops a solution to a problem, and the problem is, how to have a gun that fires more than one shot at one time, that's easy to reload. He works with the notion of the revolving cylinder, and supposedly he gets inspired by having been on a ship and watching the steering wheel of the ship revolve around a central axis. So, he gets a big contract at that time. Texans are fighting for their freedom against the Mexicans in the war with Mexico. There's a lot of action on the frontier with American settlers and American Indian groups, particularly Comanches. And Colt comes up with a firearm that enables people to shoot while riding, to reload in an easy kind of way, and it helps win wars and battles.
How does the Smithsonian get these objects?
Great. That's a great question. Some of them, like Eli Whitney's cotton gin, for example, when you would apply for patents, when you invented something, whether you were Edison or Bell or Whitney or Colt, you'd submit a patent application, and in the old days you had to make a model. And so the models all came to the patent office building, to the U.S. government, and then the patent office would turn them over to the Smithsonian in a number of donations over the years. So we have that record of invention and accomplishment. That was one means. In other cases, they come from donations from the family. The Wright brothers' plane came from Wright. The Star-Spangled Banner was carried in the family of the colonel who defended Fort McHenry in Baltimore. It was passed down in his family. Finally, his family got tired of taking care of the flag and fending off people who wanted pieces of it and wanted to display the flag in parades and marches and so on. And he kind of asked the Smithsonian to relieve him of that. In other cases, we get the presidential portraits that are donated, the mint, has given the Smithsonian a number of things, and basically people who want to memorialize their history as part of America's history basically get in touch with the Smithsonian and say, hey, I think this is significant. This happened with Helen Keller's watch, which was a neat invention, and her family said, look, this is an invention that really showed how this major figure, disabled but nevertheless incredibly accomplished, told time and navigated her life, and we'd like the Smithsonian to have it so other people could see it.
What are some of your favorite objects that you got a chance to explore for this book?
Well, you know, they really range. You know, one, of course, that I love the story of is Neil Armstrong's spacesuit. One, because, you know, here's this this suit that allows human beings to walk on the moon. Who would have ever imagined such a thing could take place? And, of course, anybody would die on the moon if they didn't have an adequate suit. So this represents a tremendous accomplishment in terms of the technology and the science to get us to the moon and to engineer the suit. What I love about the story, though, is that you would think it would be, kind of hard-headed engineering that made the suit possible. But when NASA did the competition and first looked at designs that were heavy and made of fiberglass and aluminum and all this thing, well, it wouldn't allow astronauts to actually walk on the moon. They wouldn't have the flexibility. So NASA did a competition. The winners of the competition were International Latex Corporation, known to many people as Playtex. They won the competition because they had designed ladies' girdles and other items, and therefore they knew how to design things in layers with flexibility. So, you know, in that case, you have invention coming from kind of an unlikely source that allows us to do amazing things. The other one I love, a personal favorite, is I included this Brownie camera owned by a teenage girl, Bernice Palmer. She was 16 years old. She got it, I think, either for a birthday party or for Christmas in 1912. Her mother took her on a cruise. They got on the Carpathia. They were a day or two at sea. The Carpathia gets a call, distress call from the Titanic. It's sinking. Come and rescue the survivors. Well, here's a 16-year-old girl who has a Brownie camera, and, you know, these days, my daughters anyway, you know, they're conversant with iPhones and other devices. You know, they're used to taking pictures of everything and sending them everywhere. Well, here was Bernice Palmer in 1912, whose Brownie camera was able to capture the iceberg that sunk the Titanic, the survivors at sea. It was her pictures. When she came back to New York, her film that went around the world in newspapers that showed the pictures of this amazing, amazing disaster, this important event in American history. And so here was a 16-year-old girl who was kind of doing what we imagine, well, what kids do today with their iPhones, only doing it 100 years ago. So I kind of like that story because it shows that a 16-year-old can have a role in documenting history.
Of course, with us here in radio, we're very interested in the story of Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chat microphone. I love this, and I just love the fact that this is an artifact that I can imagine FDR sitting at and delivering these very important, groundbreaking messages to the public.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing is, you know, radio was a relatively new medium. I mean, it you know, really gets going in the 20s, and people are buying radio. It is the way. And Americans had never heard from a president. You know, today we take it as obvious. Of course, you hear speeches and you hear them over the radio or you see them on the internet or on the TV. But at that time, it's hard to imagine Americans did not know what their president sounded like. And Hoover was very stilted. The few times that he was on newsreels and stuff, very, very stilted. So Roosevelt had to reach Americans, and the idea of hearing that voice of the president comforting a nation at a time of depression was so important. And I think Americans were so taken because radio brought the president into your living room or kitchen. You know, it gave Americans a connection with their leadership that before they did not have, and they felt somebody was on their side, and it was Roosevelt. He had a good cadence. You know, he had a good voice for radio. So, you know, he'd probably be good for public radio these days. So he was, you know, he had the aesthetics of his voice were well matched to the message he had of hope to deliver to Americans.
And I have to ask you about one last set of objects here, actually, that has a Connecticut connection. Is the Smithsonian has Katharine Hepburn's Oscars?
Yes.
My goodness. And so maybe you could just describe how first of all, you came to get these Oscars and why you decided to include them in this book.
Well, I included them because, you know, they help tell the story of, you know, film and cinema in this country, which has become, you know, became very big. Hollywood is, you know, really unique in the world. It's now inspired, you know, some other places. But, you know, really, again, was a means of bringing storytelling and connecting the American people, and very effective. The Oscars were not originally called Oscars, and it was really only after Katharine Hepburn's first Oscar that it started publicly being acknowledged, you know, as Oscars. Now she won four of them. That's quite impressive, and hadn't been done before, and. She had been actually a friend of hers and neighbor had been at a dinner party with one of our curators from the Smithsonian, Amy Henderson. And, you know, it's something, I mean, it's interesting because curators at the Smithsonian really, you know, do interesting things. They're not just arranging stuff in cases. They're actually doing the research. They're finding the things and collecting, you know, America's history on behalf of the nation. So anyway, Amy Henderson, our curator from the Portrait Gallery, is sitting there next to a fellow who's Hepburn's neighbor. And he said, look, why don't you just give Kate, you know, give Kate a call and talk to her about her material, because Amy was interested in movies in Hollywood and collecting. And so she visited Hepburn. She went to her house. Katharine Hepburn kind of gave her a curated tour of her apartments. Amy Henderson ended up getting a portrait from her. And then after she had died, the estate said, you know, we had such good luck with your display of her portrait. We would like to basically donate her four Oscar awards to the Smithsonian.
Mm. Richard Curran, but before I let you go, do you have the best job in America? It sounds like you might.
Yes, I do. You know, I do. And you know, look, we welcome about 30 million people a year into the Smithsonian. It's really unique in the world, the most visited museum. We do, you know, research and scholarship on items in our collection. We feel we're having an educational role. So I love it. And I guess what was frustrating, you know, with the shutdown, you know, last month during that crisis is we actually closed the doors of the Smithsonian to over a million people who wanted to come in and see these treasures. And that's very tragic because these treasures belong to Americans and they belong to people around the world who could learn about us and who we are from them. So it's a great job, but when you get that type of thing happening, it can get very frustrating.
Well, here's to Congress getting their stuff together so they can keep you guys open so everyone can explore these objects. Richard Curran is the Smithsonian Institution's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture. He's the author of this new book, The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects. Richard, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
And John, thank you very much.
Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives and Katie Talarski. Thanks to our interns, Garrett Connolly, Albert Gordon, Tess Aronson, Jackie Lauper, Corey Breen, and Greg Dyson. I'm John Dankowski. Have a great weekend.